Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Bob Nelson on the show. Nelson was the superintendent of Fresno Unified for nearly 7 years and worked in many capacities in the public school system. He's now an assistant professor at Fresno State, focusing on educating future leaders of our schools. Also, he has a great new podcast called Hashtag Militant Positivity Podcast, which I feel is operating on a similar wavelength to this program. Please enjoy my conversation with Bob Nelson, and Baker will take us there. Making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best! Fresno's best! Bob, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
So Fresno is the home of some of the best Mexican food that exists anywhere in the universe. And I'm on this journey of trying every possible taco truck in specific that I can. But there are places too, Tacos Marquitos on, I just went to Fresno State. I won't say I went predominantly for the proximity of Tacos Marquitos, but that is not a bad element in order to have that. But there's a taco truck that's run by one of the families that I used to serve in Fresno Unified that actually is on the corner of Willow and Herndon, the Baldomero Garcia family. They eat really well. I think Molly's Kitchen, if you've ever been there from Long Angles, south of town, like down in the, like on the way to Sanger, there's just a million places. That's one thing Fresno has in abundance is really good food. If I want barbecue, going to Westwoods is one of the things I really like to do. Bulldog Grill for a tri-tip sandwich is never a mistake. Anyway, I could eat my way across Fresno pretty regularly.
It's incredible the options we have. I was actually just at Westwoods last night with some family celebrating a particular anniversary. And they have like a fair menu right now in preparation for the Fresno Fair. And so I literally had like a funnel cake at my table.
All right, let's go.
Which was hilarious that I could order that from the menu.
All right, Jordan, Matt, I didn't know why I was coming on the Fresno Best podcast today, but it only took 30 seconds and now I know why. Okay.
Perfect. Okay, I'm gonna use an educational term related to taco trucks, which will make sense in a second. So for you, what is the rubric you use to evaluate a quality taco truck?
That's a good question. I think, like, I want all of the extras. If you grill jalapenos, like, I want that. If you, like, the quality of the grilled cebolla, like, it really, like, I want all of the extra stuff. If you got hot carrots, throw it in. I don't care if it's lemon or lime, but there has to be citrus, right? If you're doing pastor and it doesn't have pineapple, like, I'm just not down with you. So I just need, I'm really a big fan, particularly on the truck. Like, just go the extra mile. Whatever you think distinguishes your plate and sets it apart, I think is what's really critical. It just has to be more than onion and cilantro, right? I'm fine. And I'll eat the worst of tacos on any given day, but I like all the accoutrements, particularly grilled onion on everything, right? And I don't have to have a why. I mean, I am a gringo, like there's no question. Like, I don't need to have like lengua and sesos, and I probably don't need that continuum of proteins, but I definitely would love to, at the minimum, right? Like pastor or adobada or a good carnitas. Anyway, just making sure the quality of the meat is a factor too. And how that's prepared is really good. And a really good green sauce. Those are the key elements of the rubric that I would check off as a quality taco truck.
I think we're perfectly aligned. I for a lot of businesses, if you can operate, I call it the Weston mentality, where there's right, like all the little details, the hot rags. But for me, I love the accoutrements too. There's a place that I regularly eat in Madera that gives you a cactus salad on the side with whatever tacos you get. And even though it's not the highlight of my plate, I just love that it's on there.
And they went to Nopales, like they went the extra mile. And in Madera too, there's a place that they have a truck too, but they also have a storefront called El Tibu, and the agua de piña is excellent.
Yeah, I frequent that place. Okay, yeah. I'm not going to let us get too down this rabbit trail of tacos, which I could spend all the conversation on. So we're going to jump into some education questions. I've got a few different kind of subsets of questions I want to go through, but I want to start with you and your educational experience. Did you have a favorite teacher growing up?
I did. I think Mrs. Hutchison in fifth grade. I actually got a college scholarship, ironically enough, as a voice performance major. You can tell I didn't really do anything. Music did, even though it got me into school, it wasn't necessarily what I made my career around. But She was very serious about nurturing the things that I loved to do. And my fourth grade teacher, ironically enough, Kuczynski, really prompted my ability to write and my desire to write creatively. He also thought I talked too much, and he got a big, giant new refrigerator during the year I was in his class, and he brought the box to school and cut a hole in it, a slit, and set it on top of my desk so that I could see the board, and I was like sequestered inside this refrigerator box for the better part of a semester from my colleagues, because he was fairly convinced he would try to make me shut up. But in the end, that all won out. I had the superintendency where it's basically you're getting paid to do nothing but talk, so I was thankful he nurtured my writing, and even that bad exemplar really didn't stop me from doing the things that I needed to do. I had teachers in high school, my social science teacher too, who was really helpful in just formulating what I believed about the universe and how people orient to other people as humans and not just through a political lens. College, there's been some great ones. I think everybody has a story of a teacher who really nurtured them on the journey.
Yeah. Do you think, and this is something I reflect on quite a bit, especially having been a teacher for a long time, I'm no longer a teacher, but I'll encounter kids that will have memories of me that I don't have a reference point for. And it caused me to question, do you think we accurately remember our teachers, or do we start to tell stories to ourselves of who they were in that kind of makes it fits within the narrative of our life? I often feel like I didn't really know my teachers, if you will.
I think it's probably both. I think if you think that teacher had a seminal part of your life experience, you craft it around what your memory of that person is, and you may ascribe some belief systems and stuff to that person that they may not necessarily bring to the table themselves. But I also think we have a much larger impact as teachers and educators than we really want to let on or even remember. We're going back to some degree, we go on autopilot and you get moving by rote and you do what you traditionally do without a full comprehension and understanding of what the impact is that you have. That's what's amazing about being an educator. There's no question but that you can make a ding in the universe. But the reality of it is you don't really know where the ding is going to come from. And you don't know what you said or may have said that really resonated with that young person. And it may be something that you gave as a passing comment that they seminally shaped their life. And then in retrospect, you're like, I don't really remember that having that level of impact. But I think we underestimate potentially the impact that we have on young people.
There was a 2017 Brookings study that looked at different professions and found that people that have children of teachers follow their parents into that profession more than any other profession in the United States. It was disproportionately higher than the next. So I think the next was at least 5 percentage points lower. Why do you think that is?
I wonder if maybe we make that look meaningful, or I think maybe they're alongside for the ride when other students, I mean, nothing better as a former educator than to have your former students come back and say, hey, I just want to tell you, within the sound of this podcast, right? If you had a teacher that you really valued and you have the opportunity to go back to her or him and say, hey, you really had an impact on me in this way. Nothing brings teachers more joy and satisfaction than that. I think my kids, if they've been alongside while those kind of things are occurring, probably have some impact of that. My kids are in a district. The only time I wasn't in Fresno, I was a superintendent in Shawanakie. So there's a whole body of work there, even though they were students there at the time. Like, I have a series of relationships with other people there. And so they pieced, to your point about not knowing everything you don't know, but they pieced together the story of my journey and my life there. And it matters to them. They'll tell other people, like, oh my God, one time my daughter in kindergarten said, oh, my dad, the Bob Nelson. And that became like the running joke, the Bob Nelson. Like, God, you didn't just see that kid. But I do think, like, to them, it matters.
Do you think that teachers pursuing a kind of a multi-subject credential should consider maybe majoring in something other than liberal studies? I read a book a number of years ago called Building Effective Teachers, and it talked about the importance of math and reading comprehension for like long-term success of our students. Do you think some teachers are better off pursuing one of those as a major?
I will say this, right? The dearth of math trained professionals is critical for kids, and it's really hard, and kids struggle in math. And actually, if you want a child right now and you want them to never not be out of a job, teach them to teach math or special education or the high sciences like physics or chemistry. Like, those, you'll never be without a job. That being said, I'm a multiple subject credentialed person. I had a wide array of experiences around that. I do think that's still a viable career pathway for elementary ed kids. I do think once you get into middle school and you are teaching single subject, at least having a specialization in the area that you teach, I think, is critical. I do think There's an equity jam, which is that your least trained and prepared teachers generally have the students who have the highest degree of need. So if you can actually, anything we can do to train a cadre of teachers who are a little more prepared to teach in the subject areas they teach, I think that's good for kids, 8 ways from Sunday. But I don't throw any shade at multiple subject peoples. Like, in addition to multiple subject, but like your early learners, if you're going to be in third grade and below, like really driving down the idea that I know how to teach kids to read, I think is absolutely critical. I do think even reading by third grade is a lagging indicator. Like, a kid needs to have some phonemic understanding by first grade, and making sure that those folks understand. And I won't bite off the political reality around the science of reading, other than to say I think you need all of it. You need whole word reading, you need phonemic awareness and phonics and fluency, like all of those things. And you need to expose all the leader or the teachers who are sharing that content with kids to that the philosophy too, so that kids stand a fighting chance. Because right, literacy is fundamental to everything, even math.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think some districts I've observed them pushing hard in one direction. A lot of the Lucy Calkins fallout from Teachers College, like with representation of that, where you're just like you're leaning into one thing as a specialization, and then they miss some of the phonics that they need early on. And so, just having a diversified curriculum seems like the right
Yeah,
direction
the
that we should
love
go.
of reading unto itself, while critical, is not sufficient to help kids read, in my opinion. Right.
Absolutely. What do you think is your most underrated credential class that you took? One class that you look back now and go, oh God, that was so important for my development.
That's a great question. I haven't really thought in terms of that. I do think the ability to critically analyze anything that led me toward, honestly, we are training kids to take on a world of work that we ourselves as adults in this space can't really conceptualize. And they're going to need some strategies around that, whether that's collaborating with one another or communicating clearly. Yeah, I took a civics class that really helped me get a sense of where I want to live my life, honestly. Like, I think most of the productive work of the universe happens within the constraints of the polar extremes. And honestly, as a leader, like if I'm simultaneously ticking off people on the extremes of right and left, like the ultimate woke left and the ultimate alt, if both of them are annoyed with you simultaneously, that's probably good leadership. And the message for young people is, I don't have to actually see the world through the same lens as you do in order for us to work and collaborate together in meaningful ways, right? You don't have to share every aspect of my worldview in order for us to collaborate and work together. I just think it's a, and in the world of today, which seems to be veering toward increasing polarization, like post-pandemically, like we got super polarized, people are mad about everything. This issue of being able to be civil in the face of not necessarily agreeing seems to be more critical than.
I want to jump into education leadership questions now. According to the Institute of Educational Services, the average person, average administrator of school spends about 10.5 years in the classroom. Do you think that is sufficient time in the classroom to have integrity and the respect of a teaching force that you've spent sufficient time in the classroom learning the profession?
I do. I think it is difficult if one of the things I think our neighboring district in Clovis does is they put administrators in different levels of the organization, which I think is really right and pretty smart. I think you might, as an elementary person, for example, have trouble gaining the gravitas with the teaching staff at a high school if you had never been or walked in their shoes as a single subject teacher. 10.5 years is a lot of teaching. The difficult thing is, like, leading is not a direct one-to-one extension of teaching. Teaching, you can bring to pass much, much good of your own volition. Teaching, you actually have to work through other adults to get things done, which is a
Okay,
little.
I'm gonna jump in, Bob, because you just segued right to my next question. I want you to go ahead and
Okay,
answer it
cool.
now, which is, do you think it's wise that we draw most of our leadership from a teaching pool, even though administration and teaching are vastly different professions, vastly different incentive structures, vastly different in how you approach the job and the kind of skills that you need to be successful? Do you think it would be wise to have leadership come from other places as well? And I know in some capacity, your accounting and your maintenance and your services can come from different places, but in terms of actual site leadership, do you think that's a
I
good
actually
thing?
think, yeah, those two questions you asked in succession are critical, because I think you will struggle to keep the attentions of a teaching force if you have no gravitas in the teaching space. That being said, the behaviors are very different and the structures are very different and the ability to have success is very different. But you need to, I do think there's a reason that like the higher ups at UPS have driven a truck at one time or before, because they do have some seminal knowledge of operational boots on the ground and what those people are doing. We struggled in the big district I was in, Jordan, when people left the teaching ranks and went to a district department without ever having served as a vice principal or a principal. Because when school administrators needed some help or might have some question or something to ask, somebody who had not sat that seat probably didn't know maybe exactly what was being asked of them and might have delivered on something that wasn't necessarily the ask. So I think it's a blend. You need to have some seminal understanding of what it is you're trying to lead, but I agree completely. If you're gonna, and that's where I'm at right now, because that's what I'm doing at Fresno State. I'm taking existing classroom teachers that want to be a vice principal or principal, getting their preliminary administrative credential, and trying to really lean into that, which is, hey, what brought you here as a successful teacher may not be what sustains you in this next phase of your career. So let's talk about what those gaps could look like, might look like, and how do we go about filling those so that you have a fighting chance of doing the best you can.
Do you think an average administrator should sign some kind of contract so they're in their position for long term? I know when you have leadership turnover at sites, that can really be challenging because a new leader wants to set in their own systems. And I would, in my universe, in my experience, the principals that I've respected the most have been long-term principals in the position. But then there's also this temptation that is true in bureaucracy where you want to hop from lily pad to lily pad. What do you think about contracts? Obviously, it's not conceivable for certain reasons, but in an ideal universe.
So full disclosure, before I became the superintendent where I sat 7.5 years in Fresno, I'd never held a job longer than 4 years. That really wasn't with intention, but I do think it was what you described, which is I was moving from space to space along this journey from vice principal to principal to HR administrator and then on to a small district superintendency, et cetera. But you have it right. Nothing takes the place of stability in leadership because like you figure out for an urban soup, the tenure is 30 months. 30 months. The first year, you're figuring out what you're going to do. The second year, you're developing a strategic plan. And then 6 months later, you're out, and we're going to re-rack that. That is not a sustainable model for accomplishing anything of substance in the. And so I do think, I don't know that you can hold people's feet to the fire, but I do think like asking people to make a commitment of 3 years or longer, like in any role that they serve, like it takes about 3 years to effectuate any degree of substantive change. You think is meaningful or is going to have any staying power?
Yeah. I'm sure you've been in teachers' lounges like I have, where there'll be some complaining about site administrators. What do you think is the most common misconception educators have about site administration?
I think it's a larger issue. Like I just think in the eyes of every like in everyone's eyes, that nobody else is working as hard as they do. Whether that's a teacher and I'm looking at an administrator without full knowledge or clarity. And the reverse is probably true. Like, I don't really get everything that you have to experience. There's a common misperception that, like, somehow when you leave the teaching and become a vice principal, that you have no gravitas in the teaching domain anymore. I think that's BS. You don't immediately switch teams. There is this weird, like, us and them. Oh my God, we use phrases like the dark side. Or I just think that's a little bit of hooey. You don't totally lose your connection. You don't lose your ability to instruct just because you went into the administrative ranks. And frankly, there are a lot of teachers that exhibit a lot of leadership too without actually having the formal title. The world is based on the backs of teacher leaders. But I think in the eyes of ourselves, everybody else sucks and we're pretty great. And that seems to be a common thread.
Yeah, for me, I think, and speaking, this is globally, not any particular boss, but things I've noticed, and I see this not even with site administrators, but with a lot of people where you'll put on these two different hats when it's convenient, this like leader hat when it's convenient and this bureaucrat hat when it's convenient. And when you switch, when you pedal between those two things, if you're a teacher on the receiving end of that, you're like, well, you were doing a little bit of CYA one day, and then the next day you're asking me to follow you into the flames. So I don't know which one you want. But I also know that's just part of the job too. And so that's been one of my challenges at,
I
when
think
I was a
that's
teacher.
super accurate. And you do toggle between member of a nameless, faceless bureaucracy where I'm implementing what the powers that be want me to implement, and then my own personal leadership where we're trying to go somewhere together and try to help. I think you're always better if we're on this message of, hey, we're in this together. Like, I don't have my crap together in all facets. You don't really have yours together in all facets. But together, we have this rock star Swiss cheese thing where hopefully none of the holes align and our kids are going to be successful. But right, there's just a recognition that all of us could be better today, tomorrow than we were today. And we're just on this journey together. And me throwing shade at you and your journey, or you doing me, then the reverse, it just doesn't help kids.
Yeah. All right. We're going to jump into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you. You tell me whether you think they're over or underrated and why. The first one, softball, textbooks.
Overrated. I think they become like a crux for people. It's if there was a book that ever taught kids to be successful, it would be replicated everywhere. It's never happened. Overrated.
Yeah, I was one of those people early on in my teaching career that read that book, Ditch That Textbook, and it definitely left a formative impact on me. And sometimes we need to course correct. Our next one, the concept of growth mindset.
Oh, I think underrated, actually. I think it's hard to teach people that they are not in a fixed, like people who are in a fixed mindset who just don't think there's the ability to get better. It's very hard to move them off the dime. They struggle in many ways because education is super fluid. And if you don't have some degree of fluidity in your life, you're going to struggle. I actually think underrated.
Yeah, and I agree because I think we use it a lot, but we don't actually implement it and say what it really means and get at its core. We'll use it, kind of like how the word mindfulness has been used, where it just becomes like a meaningless term, and where if we actually really enacted it, it would change so much of the things that we do in education.
But think about a kid who thinks they can't do math. If you're a fixed mindset person and that kid says, I don't think I can do math, and you're like, yep, check the box, you're right. Like, that's just a recipe for failure.
Okay, next one. This is a Fresno staple, and I ask everybody, me and Ed's pizza.
The push to have ranch with your pizza, that was probably underrated. Me and Ed's, I don't want to throw shade at me and Ed, but it's not noteworthy to the degree that I would actually go out of my way to get only me and Ed's pizza. So in that sense, I would say overrated.
Okay, next one.
The ranch was a good play, though. I mean, let's give
Yeah,
that one.
once you've had it, you can't unhave it. It's the fruit in that garden. All right, next one. Getting a doctorate in education. Do you think that's over or underrated?
That's a great. I'm a weird one to ask because I didn't actually get a doctorate until 51, and I'm still making big time payments on that, which is very overrated. But I will say, like, the one part of getting a doctorate that I think is actually underrated is the ability to do research. If you can research things and study them out and look at the body of knowledge and compare that against your daily operational journey, yeah, I do think it's critical. Like your ability, you can just get in this operational space where it's, I'm just going to answer email today. And that's not really helping the body of knowledge that helps move the work for kids. And so I think understanding that ability of like how to use Google Scholar and how to go look up other people that have studied that same thing. And then how to be able to write with intention. I think those are really meaningful things. I think, I don't know, you could debate what's the marketable use of those skills, but I do think people who are willing to contribute to the body of knowledge in education is actually a valuable skill. For each person, that's super personal. Are you going to, if you're not really into school, getting a doctorate is not a big thing.
Yeah. I'm a doctorate in education dropout, so I can attest
All
to
right, well,
this.
there you go. Yeah, I don't know that it's all that and a side of fries.
Yeah. All right. Next one. Project-based learning. This is another one where the word's used a lot, but what does it actually mean?
I actually think I would actually say underrated still. I actually think kids involved, like, we don't do a lot with student voice and choice in education, and I think that's a mistake. I do think if you can get kids excited about stuff that they actually want to do, and your potential to do that is better with project-based learning than it is with just rote use of the textbook. So, can I, like, so I guess I would say underrated, assuming PBL, project-based learning, is used to nurture the interests of students. Like, if you're one step further and you're willing to take that and find out what motivates them and what they want to learn, and then dovetail that into what you want them to learn for that grade level or that subject area, then I would say underrated for sure.
Okay. Next one. This is not a underrated, but maybe just a either or kind of question. Do you like the new emphasis on growth metrics as opposed to hierarchy metrics? Do you think that was a good change? And what are the kind of upsides and downsides to using that as opposed to percentiles and putting kids within a kind of a stratum?
Straight story. Fresno Unified, which I led for a 2.5 year period in 33 years of, it's a growth story. It's not a story of proficiency, quite frankly. You got to tell both stories at the same time. Kids in Fresno Unified are growing at a rate that is faster than what's happening at the state level, but they're also way behind from a proficiency bar. Only a fourth of them could do math, only a third of them could do reading. And the truth of it is, Jordan, you have to tell both of those stories simultaneously because you only tell one without telling the other, you're full of crap. Right. If you just say none of these kids can learn, look how bad they are. Only a fourth of them can do math without an acknowledgement, like, no, actually, this district is moving these kids at a pace faster than other people are moving. And I get it too. Like, you started further back, so you can make big growth because you started. Like, I get that part too, but not like proficiency is just a bar. And what's lame about proficiency, what I don't think the vast majority of individuals understand is like 100% is not the measure. Like, even your best districts in the state are like, yeah, we're at like 60% of people proficient on this measure, right? 70. Like, it's not 100% goal. It's like even your best of the state is at 60, 70% tops. And so you got to have growth. And frankly, If you're ever going to close chronic disproportionality in those gaps, you got to be able to look at whether or not kids are having any degree of success. And if you only use proficiency bar, see nothing. You don't get any net. You don't see anything.
Yeah. My wife is a super nut for Formula One racing. And so she watches these races on Sundays, and they're always early in the morning. So she's always up early with the dog sitting on the couch watching people race cars in Europe. And one of the things that is interesting about Formula One is that there's a kind of a top tier people that are consistently finishing at the top. But she actually really likes watching the kind of the people towards the back as they move up in the rankings, like going from 17th to 15th is a
Yeah.
big deal for some people. But you also want to see who wins the race in some ways too. And so I agree with you. I think it's with one without the other does not make any sense.
Yeah,
All right.
I think people pick and choose. That's a classic error where people pick and choose the data they want to tell whatever narrative they're trying to tell.
Yeah. All right. Two more on the overrated versus underrated. One-to-one Chromebooks.
I think, I don't know. It depends on the user. I actually think that can be both underrated. I'll say this: technology as a means to an end. It's excuse me, technology as an end in itself. Way overrated.
Yeah.
Technology as a means to an end, probably underrated, used in the hands of somebody who understands like how that could be done and done well. Like the tool itself is a car can be used for drunk driving or it can be used for Formula One.
Yeah.
That's really a tool, right? I think it can be overrated or underrated based on the proficiency of the user. I do think post-pandemically, you're not taking one-on-one Chromebooks out of the hands of young people or teachers or that ship has sailed. Learning
It's
how to do it better, I think, is important.
Let's imagine you did pop-in visits in a classroom and say you're a site administrator and you came into a teacher's classroom two or three times in a week. And each time you came in, the kids were quietly typing away on Chromebooks. Is that a thing that you're going to be feel a sense of unease about that they're just on the computers and then there's not a lot of interaction? Or do you see that
Yeah,
as
I'm going to
something?
feel a sense of unease if there's not any interaction. The tool has to support. We're not creating, like, what's going to keep kids viable for the future to come? Like, AI is going to take on all that quiet typing. Like, that's going to take on that whole genre of work. What we're going to be needed for as the humans in this space is to interact with one another in a collaborative manner and to figure out what the ethical implications of stuff are. So if you're not nurturing kids in that space and the world that we're preparing kids for, I think it's a, yeah, that would definitely be a problem.
Okay. Last one, online high schools. You see a lot more of these commercials popping up nowadays where your kid maybe is not enjoying being in a public school environment, and you can just slide them into an online high school with online teachers in a virtual space. What do you think of those?
Yeah, I don't love it, honestly, but you're talking to a public school guy. I don't enter that space from a zero-sum game, but I will say, and you know what? Like, we still have a virtual program even in Fresno. I do think it has its place for kids who really thrive for that. One area I have to point to, you had all these kids that were in like home hospital instruction who were always in this like one-off situation, and actually a virtual space gave them classmates for the first time. But that's the exception to what I think is largely the rule. Bullying is real. It happens. It's very legitimate. I'm not pretending it's not. I would exhaust every possible nuance to help kids stay. Like, kids who are not routinely engaged with other humans may potentially struggle, in my opinion. I feel the same way about homeschooling. I understand why people do it, but I do think it takes a toll socially, and your ability to function in the world may be impacted as a result of that choice.
Absolutely. And as someone that taught during COVID, I know what that feels like, and it's
Yeah,
not.
nobody would say in digital instruction is the equivalent of regular instruction. It's just not. Anybody who's pitching you that, educator or otherwise, is full of it. It's just not. Like, the value of being in the universe is interacting with other humans. And no shame. Like, we're doing that. Like, I've never met you before. You seem like a super engaging guy, somebody I would probably would value and be happy to know. And we're only connecting through the virtual space. So great. And it doesn't replace being with somebody in a human way.
Yeah, I just yesterday, for example, I just did a podcast about this amazing African American woman jazz composer named Melba Liston. And it was a conversation with me and four scholars from around the world. And they were all in different places across the United States and beyond. And we couldn't have had that conversation, obviously, in person. And the value of that is incredible. Let's jump into some kind of more current stuff, some kind of like questions about your experiences in the superintendent role, but then also some kind of more current education related questions. One of the challenges that a lot of school districts have is local control. We have politically appointed or politically elected people running the school districts. And oftentimes you can get a mixture. You got some really high quality people, and then you have people with different agendas. What do you think locally elected school boards are a net positive for public education? I realize this is a complex question.
It is complex. I do think I struggle with people who are using the school board as the first initial rung, the farm club, as it were, of the city council or county government. Like I'm using that as a step up because then your focus is not around what is in the best interest of kids. And you put a superintendent in a place of having to play defense, blocking and tackling for young people while you get your political needs met. That's not great for a school system. There are people who are parents, and that's juxtaposed against people who are parents or grandparents who are vested in the system, who want good things for the young people of their community, and they ought to have an active voice. And from that sense, bringing people in from the local community is smart. I think you could fix it if you'd say, okay, you're not allowed to run for any, like to your point about signing a contract, tell me you're not going to run for office in some other way for the next X number of years. And then I think so that would actually be a pretty effectual solution.
Yeah, almost like a Supreme Court position. Do you want this for the rest of your life? Are you going to be invested? Because it takes a, and you know this, like to understand how a school system works, it takes a lifetime, right? Like you can't just walk in and make changes immediately because then you're changing a complex system.
And that's one of the things I think that's most difficult is everybody thinks like I'm an expert in this area. I went to school. And it is actually a body of expertise. Like I don't think not everybody believes that you can have expertise in the education game, right? Like they are pretty dismissive of it and they're pretty judgmental about it because they went to school and therefore they know exactly how things are supposed to work. It's actually a very complex system, like super multi-layered and complex.
Yeah. One of the things I talk about with a lot of my friends that work in the kind of the other levels of bureaucracy in school systems is about making bureaucracy social justice oriented in the sense of using social science to design systems that benefit people and not just benefit the system. How do we improve our bureaucracy so it's better used and accessible for our, to use a profane word, our customers, if you will, the people that are using our system?
Yeah, I actually don't think it's profane at all. I had to eat it. One thing that post superintendents do a lot is they sell products. And I always said, I will never do that. Like, careful of what you say publicly, because there's actually this tool that actually is really a customer service tool for major bureaucracies, which basically says if I send you an email and nobody responds to it, it just keeps ratcheting that thing up until it gets acknowledged and responded to. Because there's nothing more dehumanizing than putting the dictates and the wishes of your hearts out there and then nobody picks it up, nobody does anything with it. That's like super hateful. And so this tool actually used a generative AI to one, respond to people's questions if they could, and then if they can't, like make sure that people got responded to. And then actually people who were responded to could rate the quality of the service they got, like a Uber driver. And I'm doing that in live time. And not everybody loves that, but I actually think it was really worthwhile. And we owe it to people to see them in, as humans as they come in this space. Schools are complex because you don't turn anybody away. You're dealing with the totality of life's issues, right, in live time, and the totality of people from all ethnic groups, from all every definable category, right, every protected, valued category, they're all present there. And so meeting the needs of everybody in that type of scenario can be pretty tough, which doesn't absolve us of the obligation to try. Like we should try to be there for everybody.
Do you think it should be a firmer, not requirement, but expectation that if you're teaching in Fresno Unified, you have some conversational Spanish?
I think it's critical. I think I don't have that particularly well, but I think 33% of the students there speak a language other than English, and the vast majority of them speak Spanish. There is definitely a de like that, I will say, is changing in education. It used to be like, oh my gosh, those are the English learners. Single most capable group of kids in Fresno Unified, bar none, without close exception, is fully dually bilingual learners are just badass human beings. It's like a Swiss Army knife of success, right? There's just really nothing they can't do and achieve. And dual immersion has really forwarded that, right? But it's hard to do dual immersion everywhere because you have to have the faculty who does that, to your point about. But I do think basic conversational Spanish, if for no other reason than you need to be able to connect with the parents as humans. I do think it is a value. And it's one of the things that we've offered people the opportunity to know and be able to do through the adult school is, hey, like used to be the total reverse. Hey, Spanish speakers, come learn English. Now it is shifting. And hey, English speakers, what would it take to learn a little Spanish to be fluent and to be culturally competent in the setting?
Yeah, I've conversational for me might be aspirational. I try my best, and I think the hardest thing about learning a language is this kind of tendency that this feeling that we have that we don't want to sound stupid,
Right.
but we never learn unless we quote sound stupid. But I also find that even when you make an attempt, even if it's not perfect, I think it is appreciated, and so I think that's just maybe a cultural change.
I think there is value and effort to your point, right? Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of as a superintendent, you have to work with organized labor. It's just part of the job. Having reflections on some of the things that happened during your tenure, are there certain things that you might do differently, or were there certain lessons you learned you wish you would have learned earlier in dealing with teachers' unions and organized labor?
For sure. One of the things as a superintendent is you're not a human. You're like a thing. You're either a vehicle who's able to accomplish things or you're a barrier who's standing in the way of stuff. So I spent a lot of time trying to preserve what I thought was my humanity on that. But that can lead itself to potential problems too, because I had some exemplars where I saw people working together in ways that I took to be pretty unethical and some things that I really didn't care for. And as a superintendent, I took a step back and said, hey, I'm not going to deal with unethical folks. That's not on the list of available choices, right? Your job is to keep going back. Regardless of your personal feelings around that stuff, you can't freeze people out. You can't not engage. You just can't do that. And so that was a lesson learned. Like my overdeveloped sense of what it means to be like an Eagle Scout human being, it was this huge hindrance and pretty arrogant, really. I don't. You could be right, but you may well be dead right. Like you only get that degree of rightness one time because it's going to get you blown out and it's going to hurt kids. Like your need to be right is never as critically important as the need of kids to come to school every day. So I learned that. My tenure, the 7.5 years I was in Fresno, is basically two almost teacher strikes in the pandemic. Now, we didn't strike, thank God, because you look at Portland, they were on the same exact timeline as Fresno. And the impact of that strike for all of November of last year is cataclysmic, just super bad for everybody involved. So I'm thankful. But yeah, I learned a lot. Yeah, I'm a mess. I got better at that job every day and still was pretty bad and good. And also better than some, because at the time I punched out, I was the third longest tenured in the United States. So the truth of it is, you're not as good as the people who tell you you're good, and you don't suck nearly as bad as the people that tell you suck. Somewhere in the middle is the reality.
Yeah, and I think actually learning as a leader is something that, I think a lot of young leaders come into the profession and go, I need to be the one that knows everything. When you have a leader that can learn from experiences, like those are the people, that subordinates and staff respect, is those that can say, oh, I didn't know that. Thank you for helping me. That can come to subordinates and say, I don't understand how this works from your vantage point. Can you explain it to me so I can understand, so I can better support you in my role? And for the ones that I valued most as leaders are adopt that servant leadership mentality. And I think I would just love, I think education would improve so much if we had a lot of, both in teaching and administration, it's a universal thing as well.
This is where, when you ask the question of whether or not I think growth mindset is over or underrated, it's definitely underrated by virtue of that factor. Because I'm not sure I can teach you to be self-reflective and modify your worldview unless you bring that to the table to some degree, like, or at least you demonstrate a willingness to be vulnerable publicly at time and in space. Like, and it's hard in the superintendency because when you demonstrate vulnerability, people are going to jab a shiv into that area where you expose the seamy underbelly. But the bottom line is, you are best as a superintendent or any real leader. The looser you hold it and the more you acknowledge your shortcomings, the better you are at it, in my opinion.
Absolutely. One of the things that I always, and there's this particular economist that I bring up a lot. His name is Raj Chetty. And he wrote a series of very important economics articles about how teachers, the value add that they give to students in long-term earnings, in stability of households, is just incredible. And so I've sent a lot of my teachers that are feeling down on the profession some of his research because it really is empowering, but it's also terrifying in some ways because to know the size of your impact also carries with it a sense of responsibility. Thinking of that stupid thing from Spider-Man, whatever that line is about great
Great,
responsibility.
yeah, comes great with great power comes great, something like that. I'm gonna
Yeah,
believe
yeah.
it,
But
man.
I.
Spider-Man aficionados are cringing right now, like, oh God.
Yeah. And I bring that up just to say that I've had a number of interactions with people, particularly when I lived in Southern California, that I felt like the status of the teaching profession in their eyes was lower than what I think it should be. And I think we see that universally, the status. I think teachers are some of the most important people in our society. But I think the fog of politics and a lot of the things that we talk about in a broader national discourse can confuse people as to the importance and the role. So, what do you think we need to do as a society to give teaching the status that it deserves?
To some degree, we need to fight back. Like, pandemic was really bad toward teachers. We were the heroes of the pandemic as educators until we weren't. That had a shelf life of about 3 weeks. And then we became the people who were resisting kids coming back into the classroom. And then I think all of that, think about the pandemic, wear masks, people are mad. Don't wear masks, people are mad. Practice reports, people are mad. Refuse to practice. Like you could not win. And that eroded the trust in teaching. And moreover, as I said previously, like everybody has a vested interest because they all went to school. But I do think giving teachers like, you're doing that right now, honestly. Like what you're doing right now, when you give people a voice and they can talk about what their skills and abilities are, that changes minds, hearts. And I try to do it too. Some of you know I have a podcast too where I talk about those things, where I just talk about lifting the expertise of the people that are in your venue. And we need to be better at promoting the things that happen. Like there are amazing things that happen every day, and we're pretty lousy promoters of that. And even there's some weird like dynamic that's you need to like, oh, now you're being self-aggrandizing. Hell, like if you're good at that stuff, say it. And better still, put kids and their voices out in front of all of that, and you stand one layer deep. And everybody who has any value knows that you're a badass who got those kids to perform in that way. But you give them the space to have their voice out in public, and you just facilitate it in such a way that everybody knows, yeah, that person, he or she did that in such a way that it really was affirming for kids. But you have to go toward it. You have to go big a little bit, and you have to go public with the kind of things that you're doing. Like, the days of staying in your classroom, shutting the door, and preying upon the goodwill of others, those days are over. Like, you got to get people out into the universe.
Yeah. One big picture question before we transition to talking about your work at Fresno State. And I worked in Chowchilla for a little bit, which it's people, maybe some people don't know this, but there are effectively three school districts in a town of about 17,000 people. There's Dairyland, there's the elementary school district, and there's the high school district, each with
Right.
their own boards, administrations, all those things. Do you think it would be better for kids on net if more of these small school districts unified, so you could bump up the amount of, for example, in Chowchilla, they have different transportation departments, which is incredibly expensive. Those dollars could go to other places. Or do you think that there's also some things that would be lost if you unified some of these smaller districts?
I actually think that's a both and. I do think you should, like, and one of the things I was doing, I was in Shawanek Unified, which is a 1,200 student district, butted up against Yosemite Unified, Bass Lake Unified. And if they could have common transportation hub, if they could have a common food service, if there were economies of scale issues around those supplementary supports, it would have added value to everybody. Because actually, single-handedly, like each individual district maintaining a bus maintenance fleet in that scenario is not leveraging the skills that are available at your disposal. But Chowchilla is a good example of something that if you unify, you might lose. Like Chowchilla kids are like, particularly in the elementary school districts, K2 go to school together. And I don't know exactly what the breakdowns are, but third and fourth go to school together. Fifth and sixth go to school together. And that whole city of kids knows each other deeply and intimately, for good or for bad. They're all siblings. They know how to push each other's buttons, but they've been together in meaningful ways as an entire community for 6 straight years. That can only be good for the people of Chowchilla. And Dairyland probably has its own thing going too. And so I think you probably would lose some of that. If I could change one thing in the universe, I would make middle school K-8 and do that, because I actually think middle school kids stay younger longer and there's value in that. You would lose out on some of the opportunities they have to take a wide array of courses because you don't have the faculty necessarily who can do all of those things. But I actually think it's both. I think you need to look, but and I also don't think there, I think you can have some economy of scale issues where you are unifying some of the core structures without sacrificing what is good. And people ask all the time, is Fresno Unified too big? It's yes and no. Depends on what you're trying to accomplish. From a resources standpoint, it's a badass. It brings in more money in the current structure where you get funding for kids who are on the margins of need, right? It is a megalithic winner in that, because if you gave it up, kids would have less revenue. However, it's broad to the degree that you don't have one constituent base that you can immediately respond to in ways that are substantive and meaningful for that specific group. And so that's a problem.
Let's change this into talking about your new role at Fresno State. What are your goals with this new position?
Yeah, one of the things that we have in Fresno Unified is we have a teaching pipeline. Like 78% of our teachers in Fresno come through an existing pipeline, which is shaped by local institutions of higher ed, and like those people funneled right back. So we're training you as a high school person. If you have any interest in wanting to teach, we're putting you in that space. We're supplementing your courses to try and make that easier for you financially and time-wise. And it's working, right? Those people. And if you want to have a teaching faculty that represents the students that you serve, start with the students and then backward map that to get them back into the system. There's no parallel pipeline on the leadership side, at least not at current. And I wasn't feeling like I could make that change from the pull of Fresno Unified. I needed to push from the higher ed sphere with other people in Fresno Unified who are still like-minded around how we get leadership. Nobody wants to lead post-pandemically. It's messy. And I can honestly serve as a teacher on special assignment. I can get or a coach and get my itch scratched without ever dealing with kids in trouble or problematic parents or whatever. And so training people to be able to navigate that and find joy and value in that type of service is one of the things I'm after too. And I actually believe what I believe. Like, you have to be a Valley native to understand what it means to serve and support kids in the Valley. If you don't know what Hmong people did in the secret war in Laos, it's not helpful. If you don't know how migrant labor impacts the daily operational life of kids in a big city, again, it's not a help. If you don't know about redlining and 93706, like, there's just some stuff in the Valley and its history that you need to know in order to be culturally responsive to serve here. And so the opportunity existed. I got degrees at USC too, but again, then you're teaching virtually. Do I really want to do that? No, I want to help Valley leaders lead.
Okay. We always close these podcasts with book recommendations. What are a few books you'd recommend to listeners?
I think one of the ones that's really seminal and shaped my life is the Arbinger Institute's Anatomy of Peace, which is really about, can you see people as people and do you? And I forget the name of the title. I think it's something around happiness or joy. It's the book between the Dalai Lama and Bishop Desmond Tutu. And forgive me, the title escapes me, but if you just look up the Dalai Lama and Bishop Tutu, I get a lot of jam on this militant positivity thing. People are like, oh my God, you pretend things are great when they're lousy. It's not that at all. It's about happiness is not a construct of what happens to you in the universe. Happiness is a construct that you either bring to the party and then it's reinforced by the stuff that's happening, or you choose not to bring it to the party and then that is reinforced. The idea of happiness, joy, value, divinity, spirituality are generated from within, not from without.
Yeah, and I think we all, as people, need to focus on our lead measures, not our lag measures. Happiness is a lag measure. It looks at how you're feeling about the things that you're doing and focusing on the things that you're doing. If you're spending your whole day on TikTok, that's maybe something you should consider when you're before thinking, am I happy? And so I've really appreciated your podcast focus on that. And I'd encourage everyone to check it out because I think it is a breath of fresh air in a city that can oftentimes have a lot of zero-sum games and politics that are not helpful. And I think focusing on, it's not pretending like the world is rainbows and flowers. What it is choosing to focus on certain aspects of life that propel us all forward is the way I see
And
it.
I think, Jordan, not starting from a deficit place. When you hear all the negative things associated with being from, being born in, living in Fresno, like you talked about your out-of-town friends talking about that. That's not a healthy place to begin your life. You don't start from a starting line, which is 20 yards behind everybody else. Get up to the front of the starting line, figure out what's meaningful and value here, and then just run.
Fantastic. Bob, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. This has been a lot of fun, and I'm sure we could make this even wonkier and go for another hour, but I think this is plenty for people in terms of their education. That famous Ken Robinson, Sir Ken Robinson, who passed away a while ago, had that famous TED talk, and one of the things he said is, when you start talking about education at the dinner people at the dinner table, people's faces turn white, and they're just like,
Right.
"Oh God, here we go." But I think there's a lot of value in this, and I really do appreciate you talking with me.
Very much appreciate being on your podcast and the opportunity to spend time with you today. And yeah, good job on, yeah, your knowledge of local food spots makes you worthy for every single listener to be present. Best Fresno.
Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.